Good afternoon. Radio. Good afternoon. This is On Point. I'm Ron Edwards. Co-host Don Allen is on domestic assignment. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at the international scene. As we are in studio here at the McIntosh Studios in downtown Minneapolis, we are following closely a third engagement in 10 years by American military forces joined by other allied forces in what is the beginning of a serious conflict with Libya. President Barack Obama, who is traveling in South America, making his first trip, if you will, to that region of the world, has just broadcast live from Brasilia, Brazil, the capital of Brazil, explaining to the American people the American decision, the decision of his administration to enter a conflict with a third Muslim nation. President says this is not about change, that this is about bringing safety and salvation to, number one, the population of Libya, and stability to the region. Of course, we all know that North Africa is in the throes of significant upheaval, Egypt, Tunisia, and now Libya, though in prior years there have been problems in Algeria, Morocco, the list goes on. Vote yesterday in the United Nations, I call it the Coalition of the Willing to get their hands on as much oil as they possibly can for reduced prices, that being Libya's oil, passed resolutions. In fact, the resolution was interesting. It was number 1973, which is also the date of the last major conflict between Israel and the Arab nations of that particular surrounding area. But more importantly, American military forces have been engaged and are engaged as we speak. Cruise missiles being fired from American submarines and surface vessels stationed in the Mediterranean, now hitting what the United States and the Obama administration says are military targets. We, in the last 3 hours here at On Point in our McIntosh studios, have been watching a parade of military experts, all retired by and large, intelligence chiefs, if you will, who are all explaining that with the surgical ability of the United States military to deliver deadly strikes against an enemy, that there will basically be no civilian casualties. One has to know today, my friends, in this country and throughout the world, that that's not true. Best examples within modern time and recent memory are certainly Iraq, Afghanistan. In fact, in Afghanistan 2 days ago, in what was labeled, if you will, an American surgical strike, President Karzai, the head of that nation, Afghanistan, indicated that at least 19 Afghan citizens, innocents, noncombatants, were killed by surgical strikes. In fact, there has been significant conflict and rancorness, if you will, and almost outright hostility between President Karzai and General Petraeus, Supreme Commander of NATO Western Operations in Afghanistan, in which there has been a significant increase in civilian casualties. In fact, there have been significant civilian casualties since day one. But it is this propaganda, I hate to use that word on this program, but it is that propaganda that continues to lead the United States to feel a certain level of self-confidence, if you will, that they're doing the right thing under the guise that they are targeting only the bad guys, whatever that means. That sounds like something out of a Dick Tracy cartoon, if you will, or some 1960 television sitcom with Jack Webb and others talking about the bad people, the bad guys. And then when you look at the pictures, when you hear the horrifying stories, when you hear the anger that is expressed by those who have been the victims, be they in Afghanistan or be they in Pakistan, if you will, be they in Iraq, be they in Kosovo or Bosnia, if you will, in the so-called modern times, one realizes that it is, in fact, not working. It is not happening. It has not happened. It is not about to happen. And so we try to follow closely as we can, these analysis, if you will, these guarantees that these will be surgical strikes, that civilians will not be casualties, if you will, and that also this is not about regime change. And clearly it is. As we're talking, we're looking at adaptations, which show that American military presence is such, if you will, that it is difficult to determine how, at some point or another, if you are not to extract Muammar Gaddafi from power, that you do not have to put boots on the ground, as they like to say. Now, let us take a look at this coalition that is currently at play as we speak. As cruise missiles scream into and across the Libyan northern coast, hitting military targets and hitting no civilians, according to what the propagandists will be telling us, we have to assume that Gaddafi will be brought to his knees by quote-unquote allied air power, at this point being fired from naval ships. The French have taken the lead here, and this in itself is interesting. The French, the former colonial masters, though not of Libya, that was the role of Italy, if you will, but France, a former colonial master in that part of the world, in the nation of Chad, just south of Libya on its southern border, France for many years was the cruel colonial master of that black African nation. France and others would have us believe that this is not about the most important, precious, and economically guaranteed commodity in Libya, and that is Libyan oil. In fact, in our monitoring over the last 8 or 9 hours, we have found it fascinating here on Point that there has been no discussion whatsoever about Libyan oil. Now, early yesterday, during the United Nations debate, it slipped out in discussions led by both French, British, and United States permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Ms. Rice, that Libya, at the conclusion of this military effort, would be expected to pay for this military effort. In other words, they will be expected to pay for the carnage that will be rained down upon them. Now, I know a person would be quick to say, how dare you, sir, at On Point, if you will, because we are here to save the Libyan people. Now, understand, my friends, as we speak on this program this afternoon here on Point, that hundreds have already been killed in Yemen just yesterday in violent clashes with security forces of the Yemen government. Of course, Yemen doesn't have any oil, though it does sit on the common border with Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, those Saudi oil fields are far to the north of Yemen. We have Bahrain. Bahrain, a small island but extremely wealthy, having significant offshore oil facilities and et cetera, and of course having a kinsmanship with the Royal Saudi House in that they are both a part of the Sunni religion of the world of Islam. By the way, there has not been much comment or actions, and certainly no one had offered a resolution in the United Nations yesterday to either impose sanctions or declare a no-fly zone or to send military forces in to stop the killing of Bahrainian citizens, if you will. except for the Saudis, a neighbor, as we pointed out, just across the causeway, as they say, in other words, about 16 miles offshore of Saudi Arabia, who sent at least 1,000 cracked Saudi military personnel into Bahrain, and there have been significant casualties, if you will. So now we have Bahrain, we have Yemen. Oh, also we have the ongoing murders in the Eastern Congo and in the Ivory Coast. And yet there has been no sense of concern, commitment, and definitely no sense of resolve to send military forces into those specific countries to protect, quote-unquote, the citizens. Because this is what this is all about, isn't it? We want to protect those citizens of Libya who have come under the heel and the yoke of a very mean-spirited and dangerous dictator who has been in power for 42 years. On surface, and if we are brainwashed enough, we listen to it, it sounds good. It sounds great. It has to, though, doesn't it? Because if not, then you begin to have a problem within the populations of the nations, Christian nations, by the way, who are involved and who are able to deliver the greatest military punch. That is the United States, Britain, France, joined by a couple of other countries, Norway, which is interesting, Denmark, which is interesting, Italy, which we are surprised here at On Point that Italy would commit itself to an engagement, though, of course, as we said earlier, Libya is a former colony of the Italian Empire back in the day, and the Italians in many respects were very cruel colonial masters, as were the French during their days of colonial power in Africa and Southeast Asia, and even here on the North American continent. Ask those who are scholars of Native American history, both in the United States and Canada, what kind of masters the French were. Though people would say that was way back in 16 and 1700s, and certainly things have been proved. Let me just say this as a comment, as a part of this examination of the real motives of what has happened and why it is happening. When is the last time France has ever won a war? Now, for those of you that are scholars, and unfortunately, there will be no radio call-ins today here on Point, but certainly jot it down, and you can reach us next Saturday. We will, of course, both be back from assignments. But the French are a nation who is legendary with respect to starting something and never being able to win, never being able to prevail. I mean, the French have not beaten anybody since the days of Napoleon. And I think the last battle that he fought was around 1804, 1805, if you will. Think about it. I mean, this is a country that never wins. I mean, really, they lost the First World War if it had not been for the intervention of the United States in 1916, 17, and 18. They were clearly trashed, if you will, by the Germans in 1940, if you will, 1954, 55. They were beaten to death by the little yellow man of Indochina, now called Vietnam. The French just don't have a history of being able to win. Now, they have a history of being able to start something. Now, the news accounts, as we are watching monitors here in studio, show that at least 20 French fighters are over, and it appears to be that they are over eastern Libya, around the area of Benghazi, and that they have struck some military targets, if you will, and many of our correspondents and anchors here in the United States and the UK are breathless, if you will, as they talk in terms of, and here it is again, a Western nation, a white Western nation, killing people of color of another religion. I mean, you know, it's the elephant in the room. We don't like to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it. And we examined this amongst ourselves here at On Point in preparation for this international segment, if you will, that we know how controversial the statements and declarations like that can be. But if we can accept a standard in this country that what Rush Limbaugh and O'Reilly and others say in regards to matters such as this, in the name of conservatism and et cetera, we reserve the right here at On Point to say this on behalf of the left, if you will. And so, once again, as we said at the top of this program, white Christian forces, though they maintain that they have the support of Arab nations. Now, let's take a look at that. The only three countries that they have identified have been, it's really only two. It is the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and they have identified to a lesser degree the possibility of Morocco, if you will, which is on the other side and is in fact a part of North Africa, though the Moroccan foreign ministry, as we are looking at ticker tape, are indicating that though they support the need for an action, they have not committed militarily. President Barack Obama, just about 20 minutes ago in Brazil, where he and his family are on a state visit, they will be going to Brazil, Chile, and El Salvador, which that's all that's interesting, have indicated that this is a coalition almost remindful of the coalition of the willing a decade ago, going into Iraq. But let's go back and take a look. We have the white Christian nations of Europe, with the exception of Germany. And that has not set well with the United States and others, as Germany abstained yesterday in the UN Security Council. In other words, they did not vote. They did not accept the argument by the French, the British, and the United States for the necessity, if you will, of the Pacific action that was under discussion and later was to be voted on and passed on a 10-zip vote. Though it's kind of like the standings when you look at the hockey standings, it was 10-0 and 5. The 5 being abstentions. In fact, one of the kind of embarrassments as we speak with the president arriving in Brazil is that Brazil was one of the nations who abstained yesterday. The Brazilian government, not convinced that this had risen to a threshold which would allow once again for European nations with a pretense of a couple of Arab countries being involved militarily, the government of Brazil did not feel that this rose to that particular level. Now, politics were clearly played yesterday in the United Nations. Both China and Russia, who have veto powers, as does the United States, Britain, and France, if you will, chose not to take that action. And by the way, reports breathlessly once again by American commentators talked in terms of the pressure put on Black South Africa yesterday by the United States' Black permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Ms. Rice. At one point, the South Africans were not in the chamber, which meant that they were not present or would not be present to vote on the resolution, 1973 resolution, and if that had failed, if you will, or if the South Africans had not been present to deliver their vote, then certainly there would have been tremendous political fallout and embarrassment and egg on the face, particularly for the British and the French who were twisting arms and et cetera. Now, that takes us back to what this is all about. Over the last decade, starting with, unfortunately and tragically, the events of 9/11, we, the American public, have been told on a consistent basis that this is all about the war against terror. Well, one would think that those who were gunned down in the square in Bahrain, those who were gunned down yesterday in Yemen, those who were gunned down, all women in the Ivory Coast, those that are being gunned down and killed and raped and murdered in the Eastern Congo, all feel that they would be deserving of the same kind of consideration and protection. But it is not forthcoming. And the reason is that, by and large, all of those nations that we previously named do not have oil. In fact, though in the western part of Africa, in close proximity to the Ivory Coast, and probably even within the Ivory Coast, there is a national resource called diamonds. But for the purposes of the problems of world economics, gasoline still at $3.45, $3.50 here in the Midwest, still at almost $4 on the West and East Coast and etc., with the Obama administration desperately trying to get the economy back on its feet, according to the spokespersons for the federal government and economists and others who are part of the propaganda mill. Gasoline prices that are approaching $4 do not guarantee a healthy economy, and certainly we must have that by 2012. 2012, for those of you that maybe have drawn a blank or had a senior's moment, will be the next presidential election. That's why we said earlier in this program that we were rather surprised that the Italians, who have two major American air bases in Italy, have authorized the United States to engage in military actions against Libya, if you will. Italy receives probably 90%, if not more, of its oil import from a country called Libya. By the way, going back to what we talked about minutes ago, during the debate and doing the arm twisting and et cetera in the hallways at the United Nations, as we said earlier on this program, the issue of compensation and how this conflict will be paid for. First of all, we all know that the French and the British do not have air power, air supremacy, anywhere approaching that of the United States, though both of them are nuclear countries. Notice I didn't say nuclear powers, but they are nuclear countries. They have nuclear capabilities. They have nuclear strike forces, just like the Israelis do in the true Middle East. And so consequently, one has to feel that in the control centers of politics, not the control centers of military, that there must be a real concern that this not have a significant duration, if you will. In other words, that either someone will assassinate Gaddafi within his inner core, or that a cruise missile will hit his bunker and take him out, if you will, or that in their minds, Gaddafi will come to his senses and will indicate that he will leave, as he has been directed by Western leaders, and also called for by those who say they are the insurgents and revolutionaries now engaged in the battle, or he will indicate that he will comply, he will take significant and drastic actions, including allowing peacekeepers to come into Libya, create a buffer zone along with the no-fly zone, and then also guarantee that they will be allowed to take control of the Libyan oil fields. And, of course, once they take control of the Libyan oil fields, particularly those oil fields which are managed by BP, that's British Petroleum, and in which a lot of the British economy, even though the British do have oil capabilities in the North Sea, as we all know, that at that particular point, I assume that, first of all, the Libyans, though I doubt very much that Muammar Gaddafi will, in fact, even be alive to allow that to happen, that the Libyans will be given a bill for service, if you will, and will be told that they owe $450 billion, if you will. Maybe that's a little extravagant, but certainly 5 or 6 billion for this military incursion into their country. And of course, they will pay that, and then they will agree to allow the management of their national resources for the next 10 years, if you will. I assume that some of the European countries feel that that will allow them, particularly at cut rate, if you will, for Libyan crude, Libyan sweet, as it is referred to on the market, will allow a stability in Europe. Now, let's take a look at that quickly here on point. We said, again, at the top of the program, we found it interesting that Portugal, Spain, if you will, Greece, though the Greeks have a different kind, and always had a different kind of relationship with Libya. In fact, 20 years ago, it was the Greeks who exposed the fact that after the bombing of a nightclub in Berlin, in which American military personnel were killed, and which led to the first attack on Gaddafi, which the end result was to kill and murder some of his young children. It was the Greeks who indicated, I'll never forget it, it was Ambassador Eagleburg, who was the envoy who was running around the Mediterranean getting support for the attack on Muammar Gaddafi. And it was the Greeks that pointed out to the United States that the transmissions that had allegedly been intercepted between Tripoli and Berlin were not in the Libyan language. The Libyan language, by the way, is Berber. The Libyans and their clans are Berber. Really, they're not Bedouin. I'll never forget that those of us who are historians, followers of events, and et cetera, were so extremely amused. You don't see a lot of discussions about that. So Greece is not participating. Now, the reason? Portugal, Spain, Greece are broke. These countries are on the endangered species list, along with Ireland, as an example. The Irish Prime Minister just here in the United States for our international segment, attempting to request, beg, if you will, promised, if you will, financial support to keep the government of Ireland, the government of Dublin, to keep them propped up. Because there is a financial crisis, a severe financial crisis. Now, for some reason or another, the Germans and their discussions within their parliament, if you will, apparently recognized that there was a ill motivation and ill intent, particularly on the part of the French, and to a lesser degree, the British, who, for whatever reason, need to go along with this. Of course, things as I know many of our UK listeners know that things are not economically well in Britain. Oh, yes, some of us here are very strict students of the Prime Minister's Hour that is shown on PBS and et cetera. By the way, that's probably one of the reasons that the conservatives in the United States Congress are going to cut those programs out here in the United States. You will not be watching any ministers or Prime Minister's Hours or listening to a lot of the fine programs that PBS and others have been doing. But anyways, back to motive. Interestingly enough, Portugal, Spain, Greece, along with Turkey, are those NATO partners who are the closest to Libya and are certainly in the best position to deliver a military presence and a military punch, if you will, at the situation in Libya. As we said before, we were a little bit surprised on the political decision by the Italians in that they are so dependent upon Libyan oil. But now the Italians, of course, are in the position that is oftentimes used by Europeans, particularly those who have been colonial masters, that they understand the little Berber, the little Libyan, better than he understands himself. And do not be insulted, my friends in the international our international audience, because this is what we in Black America are told all the time, that white Americans understand us better than we understand ourselves. I think supposedly that's supposed to have something to do with mental capacity, intelligence, and et cetera, if you will. But in the case of those nations that decided not to participate, it raises a serious question. Now, the two countries that the president and his spokespersons earlier today highlighted, of course, as we said before, are the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, both very small nations, but very, very, very rich nations, if you will, who have very, very small, tiny air forces, which, by the way, they are flying basically F-16, maybe some F-18 fighters, and they are, and maybe some French Mirage jets, fighter jets, if you will. Now, if one were to pull out your map and take a look at the distance between both the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, you will see that it would be extremely difficult for a fighter plane to be able to fly to the new no-fly zone in Libya without refueling. That would be first and foremost, because these planes would clearly be carrying a munitions load of rockets and et cetera. And so they would definitely have to refuel, though they probably, I assume, that the greatest wisdom here is that they would fly to Egypt. But I have to tell you, my friends, that when you talk from Qatar to Egypt or from the United Arab Emirates, that is quite a distance for a fighter plane. Now, of course, if we have American tankers, if you will, I'm talking about aircraft, the C-135s, if you have them in the air over the Persian Gulf up towards the Red Sea, if you will, then I'm quite sure that they would be able to, coming across Saudi Arabia, because that would have to be the route, if you will, across Saudi Arabia, across Egypt, and then into Libya, and then turning back for a return flight, probably refueling in airfields in Egypt. I mean, those two countries are the only two right now that have been named. Now, as we said before, going to the west of Libya, the only nation that has really been discussed is Morocco. Morocco also has a very, very small air force. I find it interesting that Algeria, which shares a very long common border with Libya, if you will, has been extremely silent because they've had their own problems in Algeria with respect to uprisings and et cetera. And so clearly the Algerians, who must continue to live in the neighborhood with the Libyans at the conclusion of whatever the actions militarily are, have not offered any assistance from their basically small air force, though they have a fairly decent-sized army and ground force, but the Algerians don't seem to be very interested, and particularly in that the Algerians were so viciously and violently oppressed by the French during the occupation of Algeria over a couple of hundred years, if you will, until the mid-1950s when the Algerians and the original Muslim Brotherhood drove the French out of Algeria, if you will. Frantz Fanon, a great writer, and et cetera, talks about that in his many writings. And so we have now, as we continue to watch on screen, reporters, commentators, anchors here in the United States breathlessly talking in terms that the war has begun, that American cruise missiles are now going ashore. You basically like to fire your cruise missiles at night. It, of course, makes it more difficult to detect, particularly if your radar has been knocked out, than if it was a daylight raid. The United States, as we said, appears to have at least 7 or 8 warships. The aircraft carrier Enterprise as we speak, is moving, trying to move closer into up to the Suez Canal. I'm not sure that the Enterprise can get through the canal, so it would have to jettison its aircraft, normally an aircraft carrier such of the, as the class of the Enterprise would carry at least a minimum of 60 fighters, if you will, as well as radar planes, fuelers, and helicopters. And so I would imagine the Enterprise, which seems to be setting off the coast of Egypt in between Egypt and Saudi Arabia there in the Red Sea, would be able to send both cruise missiles and aircraft across Egypt into Libya, though I'm not sure the Egyptian military is very happy with that. But, the, of course, the Israelis have promised to behave. By the way, on that particular note, Pierce Morgan, who is America, or they're attempting to make America's new Larry King, interviewed the Israeli Prime Minister, which was shown here in the States just a couple nights ago. It was interesting to listen to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was educated in the United States, by the way, at MIT. It was interesting to listen to the Prime Minister, the Israeli Prime Minister's take on how order should be brought to the Mideast and also to North Africa, but most of his time was spent dealing with his ongoing fear of Iran, if you will. Now, let us go to Iran. Let us take a look at this, and let us take a look at the issue that has been discussed on a foreign broadcast. And for those of you that have shortwave radios, be sure to tune in to your English language broadcast coming out of Arab nations, particularly those coming out of Tehran, because the Iranians are rubbing their hands together, because there is a suspicion, and by the way, it was no accident that many of the Al-Qaeda fighters over the last 8 or 9 years came out of where? Particularly came out of eastern Libya. No one was ever able to explain that other than to indicate that this was a continued promotion by Muammar Gaddafi of worldwide terrorism. Probably was, if you will. But the fact of the matter is, has someone or is someone playing a trick? Because part of what Secretary of State Clinton and to a lesser degree President Barack Obama, and there seems to be some division between them and Defense Secretary Gates, who maybe has a little bit more intel than is given to the President and the Secretary of State, that there may be a significant ruse being promoted and that we may be looking at a significant Al-Qaeda presence in these so-called uprisings in eastern Libya, and that if there is a partitioning of the country, in other words, if the country is split with the east being controlled by Benghazi, of course the intent is to have the eastern part of the and the new provisional government in Benghazi control the oil fields, if you will. I don't know what that will in the long term do to the credibility of the quote-unquote insurgents, quote-unquote provisional government in Benghazi. But certainly it will allow Western oil companies to immediately get in there and begin to profit off of the Libyan oil fields and not have to put up with Muammar Gaddafi. Now, that then, as we said earlier, raises the question about what will this do for the economy of Europe. I imagine it will provide some relief. I'm not sure that it will do what they hope for, particularly with Spain, Portugal, and Greece, if you will, and some instability in some other nations. But the assumption is that by getting control of the Libyan oil, that it will reduce costs within Europe. You know, the Europeans have been paying $5, $6, $7 a gallon for petrol for a long time, and if you could, boy, if you could get that down to, you know, 4 to 3 euros for a gallon of Libyan crude sweet, if you will, it would just do wonders. But apparently, as we said earlier in this program, that it is not something that apparently appeals to the Germans, and that is somewhat the mystery. We can understand here on point the political strategy of both Russia and China. Now, let us go also back to oil production. The Chinese have a number of lucrative import arrangements with a number of countries. Indonesia, which produces oil, if you will, and wants to keep the most significant military power in their part of the world happy, if you will. But also, China has made agreements with Venezuela, and they're doing a lot of business there. But also, the Chinese buy a lot of Libyan oil, and they expect that that Libyan oil will be in play, if you will, and available to them, the Chinese, to help their country continue to be number two in the world economically and fast approaching the possibility of overtaking our own beloved United States of America by 2018, 2019, 2020, if you will. Now, let me go back in a little piece of history here on Point. And again, I'm Ron Edwards, co-host. My associate and co-host Don Allen is on domestic assignment and will be back with us next week. And we have decided politically, if you will, to basically utilize our hour-and-a-half program to take a look at the new war. Yes, for you Americans, particularly for you young Americans of military age, if you will, though there is no draft in this country, those that make the wars but don't have to fight them have found another venue for you to, quote-unquote, possibly lose your life or be maimed for life or et cetera, and it's a place called Libya, another Muslim country, another situation that probably will take at least 10 years. Keep in mind that we heard the same rhetoric that we are listening to right now as we talk here in studio, here on Point, that this will be a quick, decisive battle, that Muammar Gaddafi will be brought to his knees, the Libyan people will be free, and, quote-unquote, we will be a happy planet again. Of course, no one's paying much attention right at this hour to the situation with the Japanese. But then, you know, what the heck, that'll take care of itself. I assume that that's what's being said. But back to the China situation. Many, many years ago, in the 1930s, as a country called Japan was beginning its expansion, and actually its expansion had been in place for probably almost 30 years or longer, and had started with the defeat of Tsarist Russia in the Far East, and the Japanese taking control of significant parts of the Far Eastern Empire of the Tsarist Russia, if you will, the imperialist Tsar, if you will. The Japanese, by 1907, 1908, had become a serious military and political player in the Pacific. In the First World War, the Japanese positioned themselves on the right side of the conflict, in other words, with England, the United States, France, if you will, the so-called powers of that day. And, of course, the Japanese were rewarded, if you will. But by the late 1920s and 1930s, the Japanese had begun to show that they had significant visions of expanding the Japanese empire. And, of course, one of the places they turned towards was both Manchuria and China, and then later Indonesia, Indochina. In fact, almost came close to making a breakthrough over the Himalayas into India and crushing the British Empire. But what began to happen was that in the late 1930s, the Western strategists and et cetera realized what was happening and that Japan was growing in military might, and of course, they already had this crazy man, this insane man in Berlin called Adolf Hitler. But one of the things that had happened is that, of course, the Japanese don't have any oil. Japan is basically an island, if you will, with no resources as it pertains to keeping its economic and war machine going. And so they were doing like every country has done since oil, you know, was found and became relevant to the economic life stream of a society and a nation, and of course they were buying and importing, and one of the most significant markets was in Indonesia, which was under the colonial control of the Dutch. And of course, the Dutch had been fairly ugly and mean-spirited colonial masters to the little Indonesian brown people. And in fact, in the very early 30s, documents later obtained after the conclusion of the Second World War indicated that Japanese intelligence in 1926, 27, 28, 29, particularly as the Depression took place across the world, had been trying to create significant uprisings in that part of the world, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, if you will, places like that, to throw off the white imperial Western yoke, if you will. So what happened by 1936, 37, a master plan had been put together in the capitals of Europe and in the United States to begin to cut off what? Oil supply to the Japanese. And for those historians that have written honestly about what led up to the events of the Second World War, the attack on Pearl Harbor and Wake Island and Midway and the Philippines and et cetera, and continuous Japanese expansion, pointed out that the Japanese realized that they were being choked off. Embargoes were being placed because of their conflicts in Manchuria and with China. Chiang Kai-shek being the nationalist leader in China who was being forced away from his seats of power. And consequently, the decision was made that the Japanese would be stopped by cutting off their oil. Now, it is ironic that that scenario could come back into play again as it pertains to what's happening with Libya, though China, who becomes the alternate player in this ongoing scenario, as we said earlier here on Point, has relationships and trade agreements and et cetera with Venezuela. They are back in the same market the Japanese were in 75 years ago, the Indonesian oil fields and et cetera. But more importantly, the Chinese expect to have unrestricted access to the oil of other oil-producing nations, if you will. Now, our analysis here on Point was that on yesterday, when the Chinese joined Russia in not invoking a veto, if you will, the Chinese were trying to put their best face on that they would still have unrestricted access, if you will, to the Libyan oil fields without being a part of a force of occupation. One has to analyze and think through that. And so then consequently, the Chinese did not make the kind of move that could have stiffed everything. The fact of the matter is the Chinese will be extremely unhappy if the master plan goes through. What is the master plan? The master plan is to make and to bring about regime change, if you will, to do whatever is necessary with Muammar Gaddafi, if you will. A lot of these folks really, in these nations, really don't care about little brown-skinned people being killed and tortured and murdered, if you will. It's all about that black stuff that comes out of the ground called oil and also natural gas. But repeating again, if the Chinese begin to suspect that this is all a part of a much more elaborate global conspiracy to begin to stymie China's ability to continue to grow. She is now the second. She's, in fact, just supplanted, if you will, and surpassed Japan, if you will, that this is an attempt by the United States and others to, in fact, stymie China's ability to continue to grow. There could be serious consequences. Now, we have said on our television program here in the Twin Cities, Black Focus, that one of the cards that the Chinese hold is that they know that they can create a serious situation, extremely tense and extremely dangerous with the United States if the Chinese decide or begin to rattle sabers and make noise about the fact that they intend now to move against Taiwan. One of the long-held ambitions, if you will, and desires of Chinese leadership over the last 40 to 50 years has been to return Taiwan to the breast of Mother China. Now, of course, Taiwan has been very gifted, if you will. It does extremely well in the world of economics. Taiwan, basically, other than its periodic exchange of angry words with its big brother across the China Sea, China, Mother China, if you will, Taiwan basically stays away from a lot of controversy, though a couple years ago they got caught in a situation where their intelligence communities were doing some things, trying to make sure that they knew early on what China's plan was for Taiwan. But you have to believe that the little nation of Taiwan, the little island, in fact, of Taiwan, really, if China decides to, quote-unquote, bring her military might into play, would not stand much of a chance. Now, the United States, starting with the Clinton administration and a series of events in the mid-1990s, has said that we, quote-unquote, stand by Taiwan, and we will come to their defense and et cetera. And, in fact, President Clinton did make a military move back in the 1990s, when there was some increase of volume, military in nature, between mainland China and Taiwan, and the United States dispatched the Pacific Fleet. And in fact, it is one of the things that caused particularly the Chinese military, to decide never again will we be embarrassed or humiliated by a Western power. And since that time, the Chinese have been on an accelerated course of improving their naval capabilities and their air capabilities to make sure that when they do decide to move against Taiwan as a part of their ace in the hole, that there will be no American interference. And by the way, we say American only in the sense that no other power on earth, other than probably the Russians, who have no interest, could ever position the necessary military presence in the Middle Pacific, if you will, in the China Sea, to represent any kind of threat against the Chinese. So for our listening audience, give some thought and reflection to some of the play that was being given. Now, in the case of the Russians, you have to understand, we tend to forget, because the government wants to make it appear that we're so in love with the Saudis, who, by the way, in many respects, though, the Saudis are extremely shrewd in their thinking. The royal family, 60,000 strong, by the way, has done a good job of basically making sure that native-born Saudis basically enjoy a very decent quality of life. That's the reason there's so many foreign workers in Saudi Arabia, because those who are true Saudi nationals, born in Saudi Arabia, basically don't do anything but just enjoy the remunerations and the royalties that come down. So consequently, that's why there are so many foreign workers in Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia is not the leading oil-producing nation in this face of this planet. It is, Russia, Mother Russia. And knowing how Putin thinks, and Putin is just as shrewd, if you will. You got to remember, he is a former intelligence chief of the KGB, the former Russian secret police, if you will. Putin has to figure, okay, there will be a disruption for a period of time of the Libyan oil flow, while the United States and European nations and allegedly these two Arab countries 1,000 miles away, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. And so that will increase the need for Russian oil, if you will, because the market will be reduced. In fact, probably one of the first that will be running to the Russians for Russian oil will be the Italians, the same Italians who are allowing American aircraft to be deployed from two American bases in Italy against Libya. As we said at the top of this program, let us be extremely clear as we move into the last 32 minutes of the program, that this rhetoric about surgical strikes and the fact that it will be solely and totally on Libyan military positions and et cetera, and no civilians will be harmed, we all know that's just not correct. It looks good in a movie, if you will, if we can get Steven Spielberg or somebody to do a movie on war and surgical strikes and precision hits and all that. We all sit in the movie theater, or if you're one of those that pirates the movie, if you will, and eating some popcorn and drinking some pop and Coca-Cola or whatever, and we're watching the precision war machine and et cetera. If you've been propagandized that much in your mind, then I guess you'll buy into that. My friends, we can tell you there's no such thing as a surgical strike, all right, that some way or another makes civilians immune to death. And again, what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan in the last, 10 years, certainly firms that up. Now, let us go back to the issue of duration. How long will this conflict go on? As we said, we're looking at our screens here in the McIntosh studio. All the experts are on. We're getting these so-called feeds in from basically cell phones, people's cell phones. Outside of Benghazi, CNN right now showing targeting Libya, if you will. The commentators, one of them an African-American who really should know better, out of breath, if you will, talking in terms of what this means, if you will. MSNBC, it is, of course, now night in Libya. We're looking at commentators breathlessly talking in terms of airstrikes on multiple positions. U.S. Warships launch first missiles against Gaddafi. These are, I assume, surgical strikes, if you will. Even Fox Network, the Poison Network, as we refer to them here in some circles, pumped up, but certainly always playing the angle. That's one thing about Fox, always playing the angle that, quote-unquote, Barack Obama still hasn't done the right thing, whatever the right thing can be in their minds, if you will. And so these things are happening, and as we said, we watch closely with respect to this. We keep our eye on it. We continue to attempt to analyze it. It must be analyzed, my friends, because, once again, America's sons and daughters are being put in harm's way, irrespective of the mechanical end of sending in cruise missiles and doing long-range warfare. The fact of the matter is, at some point, the aircraft will go in. The French and British pilots will become exhausted. They will need a break, if you will. You cannot stay in the air in a machine like that for 24 hours. In fact, you really can't stay in the air for over 4 or 5 hours, if you will. And as we said before, there is really no help coming from the rest of the so-called Arab nations. By the way, the Organization of African States, the black African nations all below the sub-Sahara, basically were denied the real input, contrary to what's being said. And the Organization of African States, which are, you know, the Nigerians and, you know, in the Ivory Coast, and so militarily they're stretched, but at the same time, they've probably basically been told that they will not be cut into the deal that pertains to being able to acquire without restriction Libyan oil. And, you know, the Libyans have massive reserves, by the way, for those of you that study these kinds of things. They have massive reserves of oil in Libya, and consequently, they are in an excellent position to whoever takes control of their oil fields to expand the continued search and expansion of the oil reserves and et cetera. So there are some now within Europe, within the European Union, within the financial communities and et cetera, who are expecting that the euro, or the so-called European currency, will increase in its profitability, if you will, and as we said earlier, we'll get nations, particularly, again, Portugal, Spain, Greece, if you will, probably even countries like Bulgaria, Romania, kind of back on their feet, and certainly will help the French and the British, who have their own financial problems. One of the things that we find interesting in listening to President Sarkozy, President concern, love for the protection of the Arab people. He kept using the phrase Arabs. I wonder why President Sarkozy does not treat the Arab French citizens of France in the same way. For those of you that have traveled, that have been in France, that have really studied the relationship, national and racial, in France, between quote-unquote metropolitan France and those who have come as immigrants to France, if you will, to Paris and Marseille and the places, that why is it that so many, and now many young French Arabs, if you will, feel suppressed and discriminated against, and et cetera. I wonder why Sarkozy has not provided the same kind of benevolence, if you will, and love and affection for his dark-skinned French Arab nationals and citizens, if you will. But anyways, it sounded good, particularly in a nation like the United States, where we really don't have a lot of understanding and knowledge about what's really going on in the rest of the world, contrary to the fact that we love to travel and play tourists and et cetera, but really don't know what's going on in other nations, if you will. And so we kind of wonder about the hypocrisy. We think that that's going to be a lot of discussion. Now, right now, in the coming days, we here in the United States will be told that the public opinion polls that obviously are being taken. I don't know how you can take a public opinion poll in Yemen and Bahrain as an example as people die in the streets, but we will be told that public opinion polls show that there is significant and massive support for the European incursion and war that is now going on in Libya against Libya and Muammar Gaddafi, and we will be told that, I assume, for a period of time. But if these demonstrations, if these continued uprisings continue to play out in many of the nations that they are playing out, and, you know, things are not, though they're voting today on a constitution, a new constitution in Egypt, things are still tense there. Things are still tense in Tunisia. Things are tense in Algeria. By the way, the Algerian government has been very repressive over the last 3 months in cracking down, if you will, on dissent. And so we wonder at what point people will begin to lose the flavor, if you will, of being comfortable with what is happening in Libya, particularly if certain forces, this could be the Russians and the Chinese, are able to begin to put their own propaganda out and indicate that this is a charade, that there's something else at play. As we said before, we find it interesting that we see basically and hear no discussion about the most important natural resource, as we said at the top of these programs, and that is Libya's oil. Who will control that oil? How will it be managed? You know that the first thing that's going to come out is that whoever these insurgents are supposed to be, God help us all if these insurgents have a significant mix of Al-Qaeda types, if you will, who have been involved in terrorist activities against Western interests around the world over the last 8, 9, or 10 years. But the question is, and think about it, for those of you that like to text and et cetera, text your congressman, or for those of us in the United States, for those in England, text your member of parliament, if you will, same thing in France and Germany, if you will, that how will the Libyan oil be dispensed and controlled? Who will run it? What kinds of contracts will the new provisional government be required to sign with respect to who will produce and refine the Libyan oil, if you will? See, these are key questions that have to be answered if you talk in terms of the British Prime Minister. Just about an hour ago, about the same time that we were coming on here on Point, Prime Minister Cameron went on, and one of the first things he said is that it's both legally and morally correct what we're doing. Well, I don't know if it's necessarily morally correct. I know that Western society has a tendency to be able to make up and change the rules as it pertains to legality. But the fact of the matter is that Muammar Gaddafi and his government which I assume is going to be dismantled through these acts of war and et cetera, will no longer be seen in the court of opinion as the legitimate contractors, if you will, holding contractual title over their oil. And so consequently, you will already see the major oil companies, particularly BP, British Petroleum. We here in the United States well remember the integrity, honesty, and veracity of BP, British Petroleum, during the terrible times this past summer down in the Gulf. But we imagine that those big companies, Shell, Exxon, others, will all be indicating that new agreements have been made, new agreements have been reached, and basically the new provisional government has signed over its lifeblood to, quote-unquote, the major oil companies of the world, and particularly those oil countries, those oil companies which are controlled as a part of being the national oil companies of their particular countries, if you will. Think about it, my friends, because as we speak, people are dying once again. A Muslim nation in North Africa, I keep talking about the Middle East. North Africa is, quote unquote, not the Middle East. The Middle East is Saudi Arabia and Israel and Syria and even Turkey and Iraq and Iran and et cetera. But people are dying, if you will. Military armies are on the move, if you will. And, of course, the propaganda machine is at play. And it is really sad because I can well remember, as an American, that we heard the same kind of rhetoric a decade ago as the United States prepared to go into Afghanistan to oust the Taliban because of a single person named bin Laden and his associate Omar, if you will, and then later Iraq, because we were being told that the dictator of that country, who had actually many 10 years before been a very close friend of the United States, in fact, we gave him the poison gas that he used against his subjects, particularly the Kurds and et cetera. Oh, yes, there are individuals who have done the appropriate study. There are books on that. That Saddam was our friend, our buddy, our ally, if you will, until it was felt necessary to get control of, that Iraqi oil, if you will. Now, you have to understand, in both of these conflicts, Afghanistan and Iraq, our nation, this country, the United States of America, has been engaged in a military effort for over 10 years, the two longest wars in the history, other than the conflicts against the Native Americans of our great nation, in which led almost to the extinction of the red man here. This country fought the Native American for almost 200 years. That's really the longest war that the United States has been engaged in. It's just that it was not necessarily declared as a war, if you will. But believe me, my friends, as an American and as one who is a historian and has studied it, that was the longest existing war against a people. But for the purposes of our foreign endeavors, if you will, these two conflicts, Afghanistan, Iraq, are the longest existing military conflicts in the history of this country. And what it's done, it's drained this nation, okay? It has caused things to happen that has drained this nation and has led to a number of situations in which really the quality of life of Americans has began to decline and reduce itself. Oh, we don't like to talk about that here in America. But the fact of the matter is the quality of life has begun to decline, to reduce itself. Article last week in Time magazine in which Sakari talked in terms of America will ever recapture the glory of the past. I don't know. I'd hate to think that it would not, particularly being an African-American who is still waiting for the 40 acres and a mule. And for those that understand black history, you know what I'm talking about. For those that don't, it has to do with the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 and all the fairy tales that us black folk who were being freed were being told about our, inclusion and integration into the greater American society. We as black Americans are still waiting. But bottom line, heard the same kind of discussion, the same rhetoric, the same logic and rationale over 10 years ago as they went first into Afghanistan and then into Iraq. And they had been, we as a nation, had been there for 10 years as an occupying force. I've already heard this afternoon here on the, particularly the cable channels, that we expect the possibility of a presence, if you will, an engagement, not necessarily direct military, but an engagement which will ultimately evolve into what has happened in Iraq and what has happened in Afghanistan, where you're fighting insurgents, you're fighting a guerrilla warfare, you're fighting an urban warfare, and your sons and daughters are dying. And really it becomes tougher each and every day for the propagandists to put out the right kind of information to cause you to buy in, quote unquote, to the rationale, to the logic, to the theory of why we are still there. Now, of course, President Barack Obama, part of his campaign promise, indicated that he would change things, that we would disengage, if you will, from the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and certainly he's trying to live up to that. But do you realize, my friends, that there are more people dying now in Iraq and Afghanistan than there was 10 years ago when this and these coalitions of the willing and coalitions of the brave and coalition of Odyssey, if you will, because that's really what it is, embarked upon this great crusade to save the little Muslim people of that particular region of the world. Yes, that's really what it was all about, if you will, bringing Christendom to that part of the world. See, we don't talk anymore in this country about some of the discussions that went on in the Bush White House when Reverend Billy Graham and the late Jerry Falwell and that whole crew used to sit down with President Bush. And the prime part of the argument didn't have anything to do with dealing with dictators and et cetera. It had to do with the need to deal with fundamental Islam, if you will, and with Islamists and et cetera, and that it was important. This is the discussion that was going on in 2000, 2001, 2003, that we need to get the minds of the Muslim people right. Their minds need to get right, that some things have been lost since the days of colonial power. And we need to get their minds right. And one of the ways to do that is to impose Christendom on them, returning to the days of the Crusaders and Richard the Lionheart and the battles for Jerusalem and other places. I mean, I know that some are saying, my God, this is far-fetching, has nothing to do with it. Certainly it does. You'd be surprised at how the thinking of a people, the thinking of a human being, really doesn't change as much as we'd all like to pretend that it does, because we are more enlightened now than we were yesterday, and more enlightened than we were 20 years ago, and more enlightened than we were 100 years ago. It really doesn't work like that, my friends, because one of the problems is that intellectually we are not as creative and innovative as we like to think that we are, and many ideas that we think that we come up with are thoughts, reflections that we heard someplace else in some timeline, if you will. And this whole thing about, and you see there are those of you out there who are great readers and studiers and et cetera, well, remember the discussions in this country, particularly after 9/11, but even before 9/11, about the importance of getting the minds of the Muslim populations right, that their minds were beginning to drift too far, that they were beginning to pair off against the control of white Christendom, if you will, and that things needed to be corrected. And that battle, by the way, has continued now for the last decade. I mean, clearly there's a battle for the minds. And the final part, as we begin to wrap here on point, has been a predicament that this country has gotten itself into just as we speak. As American cruise rockets and weapons of destruction and mayhem are now going into Arab cities, into Libyan cities, which really, contrary to what you say about these smart bombs, really can't distinguish between a target, if you will. You just hope that there aren't too many civilians around. You hope you hit the right target, and et cetera. But what has happened, that once again we are engaged in a conflict in which we are, quote unquote, involved in the killing of people of color. And we did a program on our television program here about a year ago in which we gave the list of the conflicts that this country has been in, starting with its war against the Native Americans in the effort to, a successful effort, to take control of this part of the continent, if you will, that became the United States of America and Canada, if you will, and Mexico, when you talk in terms of the history and the violence, the degradation that was imposed upon the tenants that were here before, quote unquote, the European got here, if you will. And when you talk in terms of how these things were done, it was always, in the final analysis, in the name of Christ, if you will, in the name of Jesus, if you will, in the name of bringing a civilized and Christian mentality, if you will, to the heathens that reside within this very desirable land, if you will, that has produced so much. Think about what this country has produced. Just the United States of America has produced in our 200 and some year history. And think about the people who were the original occupants, who were here when they landed in the Caribbean and thought they were in China, when they landed at Plymouth Rock, when they landed in Florida, you know, when they landed in Mexico, when they landed in Newfoundland, and renamed it, and et cetera, that these people were doing all right. They were doing all right. You know, there was plentiful land, plentiful food, plentiful crops, if you will, and they were by and large free of disease and et cetera, and their whole world got turned upside down. Well, for whatever reason, both theologians and et cetera in their great writings in the 14 and 15 and 1600s and et cetera, began to reflect as if this was some kind of calling, if you will, that this was some mandate from God that we, this is them talking, that we go into the hinterlands, that we, quote unquote, educate and make civil, if you will, the little heathens and savages of the world. Now, of course, you have to understand in a place like South America is an example. In the Andes, the great empires of the Incas, and moving further north, the Mayas and others, and tribes which we have no idea that they existed because folks haven't been able to interpretate either the language or they, quote unquote, early on just destroyed it out of both ignorance and intentional malicious conduct to destroy the existence of a society. And we say all that. We have gone into this over just the last couple of minutes because you have to believe it. I really saw it when I saw one of Muammar Gaddafi's sons, who has a degree, a couple degrees. In fact, I think he has a doctoral degree in economics and et cetera, which, and by the way, got it from the London School of Economics. You have to understand that there are other people who think just as well as those who are part of the so-called European experience, if you will. And this is one of the great battles, by the way, that goes on here in the United States, in Black America, that we have to understand that all of God's so-called gifts of intellect and vision and insight did not stop and reside with white Christians, that there are many people of all colors and persuasions who are able, subliminally and otherwise, to reflect and think and analyze, if you will. And they've been doing it for a long, long time. In fact, in some civilizations, they were doing it before there was a civilized Europe. Oops. You know what I'm saying? Before there was a, quote, unquote, a creation of meaningful thinking, reflective thinking, and great vision. As we said before, We still think in terms of Socrates and Homer and Aristotle, and you see a couple of them meticulated. They were instructed and they learned, you know where? In the great, quote-unquote, black universities of Africa, if you will. I'm a Ruby, in places like that where if you make mention of of the great universities of Amarubi and et cetera, that folks laugh at you as if you're making something up. But if you read the Greek scholars, as an example, if you read their writings, their teachings, when they talk about their experiences where they were able to begin to nurture the importance of information, of history, of knowledge, if you will, they enhanced that knowledge and understanding by going to the cradle of civilization in many respects. There, along what is called the so-called Horn of Africa and et cetera, and deep into Black Africa and et cetera, into the great empires and within those empires and civilizations, universities, places of great learning and et cetera. Yes, for those of you that doubt, go to the library next time, or you have your computer, call up the history of people like Homer, Aristotle, Socrates. I name those three because those are basically the three that you are made aware of. And take a look at their bios. Take a look at their real history that has not been purged. You may have to go to the National Library of Athens, if you will, because here in the United States, I'm not sure that we have retained or that we've even tried to retain the in-depth information about the existence of great civilizations, institutions of knowledge, and et cetera. And we say all that to say that there are others who are not of the European origin or persuasion who think just as well. And, you know, in closing, and that doesn't mean that we are a fan of Muammar Gaddafi's or what he has done or Saddam or others, but the fact of the matter is that these men, and particularly a man who has stayed in power for over 40 years, if you will, is not an individual who is a buffoon. He is a man who is well-versed. And in fact, he understands and has really a better knowledge of how the West thinks than the West understands how he thinks and how the Muslim world thinks. But I go back, as I said once again, to the period of 2000 and 2008 when there was much discussion about the need to Christianize the so-called Muslim and Islamic world, if you will. And so we continue to keep that in mind. We enjoy the opportunity to have been with you this afternoon. As I said, Don Allen has gone off to a domestic assignment, and hopefully we will be able to hear from some of you as it pertains to some of the reflections that we have made to you over the last 50-some minutes, as we, along with the rest of you that are not enjoying your Saturdays here in the United States, as we look at the pictures and we hear the narratives. And so, once again, on behalf of our co-host, Don Allen, we want to thank you for being with us, and we will be back with you next week. Thank you.